August 4th, 1914 was a Tuesday. The front page of the New York Times included the text of a telegram from King Albert of Belgium to King George of England, appealing for England's support against an imminent invasion by Germany. At 11 o'clock that night, England declared war on Germany. Today we have many institutions that we assume will safeguard against something like World War I occurring again. The UN and other international organizations, international treaties, instantaneous global communications, a global economy, and more democratic governments in more countries. Nevertheless, New York Times columnist Roger Cohen argues that the trigger points are in place that could lead to another world war. His essay, Yes, It Could Happen Again, appears in a special issue of The Atlantic that collects decades of writing from the magazine, and I'm very pleased that it brings Roger Cohen, who has a forthcoming family memoir called The Girl from Human Street, Ghosts of Memory in a Jewish Family, also coming out soon. I'm very pleased to welcome you back to our show. Hi.
Great pleasure to be here.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists still maintains its doomsday clock, representing their assessment of how close humans are to annihilation. And it's at 5 minutes to midnight now. Do you think something is happening to bring us nearer to midnight?
Well, it's kind of an eerie moment, a century on from World War One, and we've had the first annexation of European territory by a major power in Crimea by President Putin of Russia. And there's a great deal of unrest in the east of Ukraine. We've had the shooting down of a passenger plane over Ukraine, obviously war in the Middle East. And all this is happening at the same time as the guns of August a century ago. And much has changed, but the world right now feels pretty fragile, I think.
Well, these are all localized wars. When you say it could happen again, are you talking about a global war involving many nations? A war of the most terrible kind, that one, the kind that uses today's worst technology, as Europe did with gas and other weapons in World War One?
Well, we certainly like to think that we've come a long way since a century ago, and many institutions, including the United Nations, are in place, and instant communication, I think, makes some of the events of a century ago much less likely. Nevertheless, I think it's easy to underestimate how quickly things can cascade. A century ago, also, World War I began at a time of great technological progress. The world was congratulating itself on the new bonds of trade and understanding that existed, and nobody expected what happened to happen after Gavrilo Princip, a Serbian nationalist, shot the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914.
Which my teacher...
I mean, imagine if following the shooting down of this plane, Europeans, perhaps backed by the United States, had decided that the outrage of these bodies just lying there rotting in the sun was too much to take, and that a small force should go in to secure the area to make sure that the evidence was retrieved and the bodies of the dead. Or imagine in the Baltic states if the Russian minority, let's say in Estonia, became restive or was led to become restive by Moscow in the same way as Russian speakers in the eastern part of Ukraine. And, of course, with the Baltic states, you're then talking about Article 5, where we, the United States, are committed to come to the defense of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, were any hostilities to break out there.
I was taught in my high school history class that the assassination of Archduke Francis Ferdinand was just the spark that finally set off a war that was already almost destined to occur. Are these situations today anything like that?
Well, I think it's easy with perhaps you were taught a little bit wrong. I think a lot of people did not expect, absolutely did not expect, what happened to happen. All the monarchs of the empires at the time that then collapsed in short order over the ensuing 4 years with 16 million dead. They were all related to each other. They thought they could finesse the problems. Austria-Hungary had annexed Bosnia 6 years earlier, and a conflagration had been avoided. So I think there's often a feeling that these things will not happen. Look, I'm not arguing that it's likely to happen. I'm just saying that at a time when the United States is changing its role in the world in a fundamental way under President Obama, it's in a phase of retrenchment. It has pretty much made clear that it will do its utmost to avoid entanglement, be it in Ukraine, be it in Crimea, be it in Egypt, be it in Syria. And we've lived Pax Americana since 1945. Now, the United States, after the very painful post-9/11 wars, is stepping back. This leaves a vacuum.
Although there are politicians like John McCain who suggest that we get involved in all of these conflicts.
There are. The president doesn't agree with him, and I think most of the American people don't agree with him. But I do agree with John McCain in the sense that I think when a U.S. president sets a red line, as President Obama did in Syria over the use of chemical weapons, and then marches the allies up the hill in preparation for something, and then marches them back down again and says, okay, that was a red line, but we're going to sidestep it because we're going to sidestep it. One thing we should be clear about is the rest of the world takes note. And personally, I'm not convinced that there wasn't, to some extent, a perception of weakness and retrenchment in the White House that has led Russia to feel that it can do what it likes in what it calls its near abroad.
So was Obama's mistake in making the red line statement or backing off after he made it?
I think once he made it, he had to uphold it. I think a reasonable red line is the use of chemical weapons. I mean, this takes us back again to World War One, and these are unconscionable weapons. And I think it was right to set that red line, wrong not to uphold it once it had been set.
But wasn't the need to be tough what led to conflict in World War One? What are you doing after you bombed Syria today?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, it was a cascade of events. Austria-Hungary felt it had to react to the assassination, declaring war on Serbia. Then the Russians come in saying they have to stand by their Slavic allies and so on and so forth with France. And then Germany coming in. But I think, Leonard, it's a tough call as to what is more dangerous, to say that you want to avoid using force at all costs because it can precipitate events such as World War One, and suggesting to the world that there are no longer any ironclad principles that will lead the United States to use force in the event that a red line, or let's say Article 5 of the NATO Treaty or Article 5 of the Treaty with Japan, is flouted. I think you get into equally, if not more, dangerous territory when you find yourself in a world where a lot of countries are beginning to question whether those treaty obligations, those red lines, hold. The reason most of us have led relatively peaceful lives compared to Europeans and Americans who lived in the first half of the 20th century is because those principles were seen as firm.
My guess is Roger Cohen, whose article, Yes, It Could Happen Again, Instability in Ukraine, Chaos in Syria, Conflict in the East China Sea, the trigger points for World War II are in place. are in a special issue of the Atlantic magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Isn't the United States involving itself in other ways by supplying arms to some of the combatants, also using drones widely, spying on pretty much everybody? So is it a matter of just changing our role or the tactics we see in carrying out that role?
Well, I think the president is trying to change the role. Certainly, everyone agrees that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were failures, and at tremendous expense. Look at the state of Iraq today. Look at Afghanistan today. Probably if we'd completed the job in Afghanistan without getting distracted by Iraq, a war begun under false pretenses, we would find ourselves in a very difficult situation. But I think if you look at the world more broadly, there is a transition underway. China is rising. It is more and more difficult for the United States, still by far the greatest power there is, but its power often is not determinant. It cannot work without working with allies, working with others. So you have a world in flux, and I think the president is trying to make that adjustment, as well as trying to be sensitive to the mood in the country, which is clearly a mood that is hostile to any of the kinds of involvement we've just seen. And his answer has been to use drones, to use pinpoint methods, rather than massive use of land armies. And as we know, former Defense Secretary Gates said any president in the near future who went for that kind of Iraq/Afghanistan approach would need his head examined. And that quote has resonated for obvious reasons.
Another quote that's resonated was the one that President Obama said last week: in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks. We did things that were contrary to our value. Tortured some folks made it sound like, oh, well, we didn't do a lot there, but we shouldn't have done it at all. And in the Atlantic issue, your essay is in, includes writing from people like Bertrand Russell, H.G. Wells. Wells advocates a world government. Russell seems more skeptical, even though he is a pacifist. He said, most men do not mind being wicked, and the few who do mind have learned ways of persuading themselves that they are virtuous. But except in moments of passion, men do mind being foolish.
Well, I think the president looked a little foolish with that quote. I mean, I think I certainly have a double reaction to it. The first is that it's right and refreshing that the president is not mincing words. He is using the word torture, which was strenuously evaded for a very long time. And that is what waterboarding is. That is what went on at these dark sites. And on the other hand, some folks, you know, suggest we're kind of all out for a barbecue somewhere. And, you know, these are people. We tortured some people. We tortured some human beings. So that was not a felicitous turn of phrase. You know, as for Bertrand Russell, well, I think that's all beautifully put. And we got into World War One because, to state the obvious, human beings are fallible. I think if you'd said to the Kaiser or anyone of the leaders at the time, something has happened in Sarajevo, which you may find extremely provocative, but do you think it's worth 16 million lives? Do you think it's worth the collapse of four empires? Do you think it's worth the fall of the Tsar and the arrival of Bolshevism in the Soviet Union? Do you think it's worth a treaty that concluded the war that contained within it all the seeds of another conflagration in Europe within a generation? Well, you know, any right-headed person would have said, no, please, let's just sort this out by some other means. But I think that's the point. In a way, I was trying to be provocative in this essay. Again, it's not that I think that there is any great likelihood of World War III erupting anytime soon. But I think pessimism is needed in world affairs, and I think there's a tendency, maybe particularly in Europe, to ride along on a blithe feeling that with the end of the Cold War, all the threats are gone, and we tended to laugh at President Putin when he described the collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest geostrategic disaster of the 20th century, or words to that effect. He was serious. We weren't serious. He was.
Well, there were a lot of things that happened during the 20th century. That was just one of the important things that happened. I guess from Putin's point of view, that was more important than the Holocaust, World War II, World War I. I don't know. There were some pretty awful things.
Some of us might regard the liberation of hundreds of millions of people throughout Central Europe and indeed in Russia itself as far from being a disaster, one of the great triumphs of the 20th century, one of the great moments in the 20th century when the Iron Curtain fell, the wall came down, and people breathed the air of freedom. He obviously was a KGB agent who had a different view of what is good for humankind, and he seems to be still of that view today, and to be making the risky argument that the largest nation on the face of this earth, the Russian Federation, is encircled, humiliated, endangered. I covered the war in Bosnia. I know that that kind of language is very dangerous. It's exactly the language that Slobodan Milosevic unleashed in Serbia. He described the Serbs as humiliated by the breakup of Yugoslavia, by the loss of lands he believed were forever Serbian. He believed Serbs had been insulted. And with this kind of language, nationalist language, he whipped up a frenzy that many of us recall and that resulted in several years of war. One of the things about this kind of language that we're seeing now in Moscow and this kind of behavior is that the genie gets out the bottle. Maybe Putin is trying to roll some of this back, but it's difficult.
Yeah, a couple of the nations that were created after World War I, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, have broken up. You also seem to suggest several conditions that held before 1914 that seem to hold again today. And we're going to take a little break. When we come back, let's talk about some of them and why they are important to pay attention to. My guest is Roger Cohen, who has done a special Atlantic Monthly issue. His essay is "Yes, It Could Happen Again: Instability in Ukraine, Chaos in Syria, Conflict in the East China Sea." Forgot about that one when we were talking earlier. The trigger points for World War III are in place. We'll be back with more right after this. We are back with Roger Cohen. I'll mention again that he has a forthcoming family memoir, The Girl from Human Street, Ghosts of Memory in a Jewish Family. When is that coming out, Roger?
That's out in January from Knopf.
And meanwhile, we have this article in the Atlantic magazine called "Yes, It Could Happen Again: Instability in Ukraine, Chaos in Syria, Conflict in the East China Sea. The trigger points for World War III are in place." Several conditions, you say, that held before 1914 seems to be holding again today: relative peace, shared interests, wealth devoted to understanding, annexations, and a disbelief in the possibility of global war. Before we get to the others, what's wealth devoted to understanding mean? Why is it relevant to the current situation?
Well, I just meant that you had a lot of people with new fortunes who were dedicated to acts of philanthropy. There was a great
belief. Isn't that good?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, but believe that humankind, a bit like the positivism in the late 19th century, believed that humankind was irrevocably set on a course of progress, a bit like the way at the end of the Cold War, President Clinton suggested that Countries, nations from then on had more or less agreed on the basic things, and from then onward would act in terms of enlightened self-interest, that there would no longer be sometimes destructive competition of the great powers. And I think looking at the world right this minute, whether images from Gaza, Ukraine, I mean, all that, it's understandable in the euphoria of the 90s, with, you know, both economic and geostrategic, but it's proved to be unfounded. And I think some of the atmosphere that was prevalent in the run-up to August 1914, look, the world has changed dramatically, and I do think that the extreme immediate hyperconnectivity of the world today definitely helps to avert tragedy. But I think it's very dangerous to abandon caution.
Well, the things that we focus on, ISIS, the intermittent battles between Israel, Hamas, and Hezbollah, Central America, Asia, Eastern Ukraine, there have been any number of others, all are localized. Is it possible that they can spread into something bigger? I mentioned the East China Sea. That looks like a lot of countries could get involved, and they all have treaties with other countries.
Yeah, I think even though Ukraine is very combustible right now and the Baltics could be, I think there's no question that the likeliest locale, if God forbid, that there was to be some other conflagration on a massive scale going way beyond the local conflicts you just described, then I think Asia is probably the most likely, because it's there that you have a fast-rising power, China, that has been asserting its rights both in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and it's making countries, U.S. allies like Japan, new U.S. friends like Vietnam, countries like the Philippines and Indonesia, they are uneasy about this, and they like the fact that the United States is an Asian power. China, on the other hand, while not imposing its own Monroe Doctrine in Asia, is, I think for the moment, sees advantages and disadvantages in this U.S. presence, because it wants to go on rising peacefully. But long term, certainly would like to see that presence diminish. And just recently, we've seen a lot of tension over what Japan calls the Senkaku Islands, what China calls the Diaoyu Islands. And, you know, it's easy to imagine that something like that, if not adroitly handled, could build up. And then the United States is committed to protecting Japan. There have been similar tensions with Vietnam and the Philippines over oil rigs and China's evident desire to assert rights in waters that are contested.
Wasn't the UN established to deal with those kinds of issues? Obviously, the League of Nations, which was established earlier to do this sort of thing, didn't do a very good job of keeping us out of World War II. But is the UN any more capable of preventing some serious war in the South China Seas?
I think the UN, the fact of its existence diminishes to some degree the likelihood of the worst happening. There is a forum in which the great powers can meet, often to arrive at paralysis, as we've seen over Syria. But nevertheless, they are in the same room. But as somebody once said of the UN, it tends to be an umbrella that comes down in a storm. And I think if we just think, okay, the UN's there, so none of this is going to happen, then that's a dangerous bet. And you know, when I see, again, coming back to the point we were talking about earlier in the show, when I see President Obama in Asia, kind of umming and ahhing, you know, we hit singles, we hit doubles, you know, okay, you alluded to Article 5. with Japan. You're just trying to get me to say that every time a conflict breaks out, we'll get involved. Not saying, yes, Article 5 is a firm commitment for us, the Senkaku Islands, fall within that commitment. Everybody should be aware of our position. Again, I think when you get that kind of ambiguity about American commitment to the treaties and alliances that have done exactly what you just said, Leonard, just have managed to keep conflict local on the big one. Why has Putin acted in Georgia and Ukraine? Because they're in no man's land. They're not in NATO. They're not anywhere. So, but it hasn't happened yet, thankfully. In the new states, in the states admitted to NATO after the end of the Cold War, there's a big argument over whether that was a good idea or not, you know, whether it increased Russia's sense of encirclement, quote unquote, or whether it guaranteed that those countries would stay democratic and prosperous and ensure that what has happened in Ukraine would not happen there. I'm firmly, as you may guess, of the view that expanding NATO was a very good thing, but it's
and many disagree. People like Stephen Cohen, for example, not a relative.
My colleague Tom Friedman. Many people disagree. Yeah.
30 years ago, political scientists like Graham Allison and Joseph Nye drew analogies between 1914 and nuclear strategy. Is there any reason to be more concerned about parallels now than we were then?
Well, Graham Allison has described the situation with Iran as a creeping Cuban missile conflict. And there's no question that that situation remains dangerous, fraught with potential dangers. I don't think any American president could accept the Islamic Republic going nuclear, given Iran's interests and behavior in places like Syria and Lebanon. And that is why I think the talks currently going on to try and get a long-lasting agreement on Iran's nuclear program are so critical, and why I think people who try to sabotage these talks, be they in Israel or even in Congress, I think they're misguided. I think that would take away a lot of danger from the world, nuclear danger from the world, if a long-term agreement were reached. But it's difficult. That, I think, is the most delicate nuclear issue in the world today.
Well, the late political scientist Kenneth Waltz argued that a nuclear-armed Iran would stabilize the Middle East by counterbalancing Israel and its nuclear capability. Isn't that kind of what happened with Pakistan and India? Do we see any possibility of a nuclear war between those two, even though they both have the bomb?
We don't see anything more than a remote possibility of that, though when you get something like the terrorist attack in Mumbai, that has to be handled carefully because things can escalate, and while relations have improved, they are still very fraught. I disagree with any argument that a nuclear Iran, a nuclear-armed Iran, and we should remember that the Ayatollah Khamenei has said that there is a fatwa in Iran against Iran becoming a nuclear power. The Islamic Republic has survived in part because it's proved itself to be a prudent power. So I think the Islamic Republic wants to get close. I personally am not persuaded it wants to make a bomb because of the dangers inherent in that. But I do not agree that somehow a balance of terror or a balance of nuclear might would be advanced in the Middle East through Iran acquiring a bomb. I mean, the Middle East right now is so combustible, so volatile. What's been happening is just so awful. I feel really sick about it. I think a lot of people do.
I want to go.
That's a somewhat different subject, but
I want to go back to. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think to introduce into that mix a nuclear-armed Iran would be foolhardy.
I want to get back to the doomsday clock of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Although it was originally set up in fear of nuclear war, it's been marking the threat of climate change since 2007. Could we be looking at a risk that's more immediate or worse than climate change? Haven't there been some studies that suggest that climate change makes conflict more likely?
Well, I think if you get shortages of water in certain areas of the world, and
like California,
I don't see war breaking out there though. That's a tough one. There are in Africa too. There have been suggestions that in southern Sudan, it certainly contributed to the hostilities there. But I think that's, if that's a clock, I think it's one that's moving slowly, and that it's hard to link it, I think, to an immediate danger of the kind of eruption or conflagration we're talking about here today.
So even though we're just 5 minutes to midnight, that's a very long 5 minutes.
Let's hope it's 5 minutes that goes on at least through the 21st century.
Was it fun looking at all the possibilities in preparing this article?
It was, and you know what was weird was, it made me think because, I was thinking of possible scenarios and I wrote one out in that piece, but it never occurred to me that a bunch of separatists might be given a missile system by Russia, get across the border, confuse a Ukrainian transport plane with a Malaysian Airlines civilian passenger plane on its way to Kuala Lumpur, press a button, shoot it down, and then everything that followed from that. I think one of the things that didn't occur to me in my wildest dreams. So, nor, I think, did anyone think about what could happen, or whether Archduke Ferdinand could be assassinated in Sarajevo. So it's always...
Roger, we've got to leave it there, unfortunately.
It's the thing you don't predict.
Roger Cohen's article, Yes, It Could Happen Again, Instability in Ukraine, Chaos in Syria, Conflict in the East China Sea, The Trigger Points for World War III Are in Place. It's in The Atlantic. And thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.